Thank you. Who was that? Thank you very much for that. Thank you, Ian. Thank you to the Glasgow Skeptics for inviting me along tonight. And it's very nice to see so many people here. That's a great pleasure. I guess people enjoy a bit of the old, porn. Just let me grab that. So yeah, in the past few months, I've been watching a lot of porn. And you might ask, well, where's the difference there from your usual activities? But the difference is, I've also been reading a lot of porn research. I read a couple of books that were written recently about pornography, from an anti-porn angle. And I thought that it would be interesting to do a kind of a scientific literature review of the available sort of research that into pornography and the effects that pornography has on people. And so that's what this talk is largely about. A sort of health warning, as it were, beforehand. This talk does include, sort of just necessarily because of the sort of things people say about pornography, this does include some talk about rape and paedophilia, things like that. So if you're not comfortable with that, then I suggest this is probably not the talk for you. That's fine. Okay, so now that nobody has left, to get you into the mood, what I thought I would do would be to show you some porn. So here we go. Let's show you some... a little bit of porn there for you. Another little bit of pornography there for you. Actually, I did this talk a few weeks ago in Liverpool, and an archaeologist came up to me at the end and hassled me for ages. This is just a cheap joke. An archaeologist hassled me because, they might be fertility symbols. They might not be pornography. Well, all right. Okay. This is porn. This is clearly porn from about 2,000 years ago. And the reason I'm putting this stuff up is because it's I'm trying to show that pornography is something which humans have been doing for a very long time. It's clearly something humans want to do. There's clearly a demand for erotic materials or sexually explicit materials. That one is quite explicit, isn't it? I bet you weren't expecting to see any of that tonight. Anyway. So before we really kick off into the talk, I sort of make some general points. So the first thing is, if you're sort of morally opposed to pornography, so there are some people who some people who think that, you know, all pornography is degrading, sex on camera is inevitably morally wrong, and that's fine to think that, but we're not actually going to be talking about that sort of argument tonight. We're just going to be trying to take as dispassionate as possible a look at the evidence. The studies that have been done. The reason people might be morally opposed to pornography might have something to do with pornography's effects on our sort of disgust systems. So David Hume said that morality should be the slave of the passions, and actually he's been borne out by recent psychology research. So for instance, this is a man who's disgusted. What an education you're getting tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Some recent psychology studies have shown that the more disgusted people are, the harsher they are when they have to make moral judgments. So you give people little stories about, you know, there's a man who went down to the shops and stole some bread to feed his family and so on, and you have to judge how morally wrong that was on a scale of 1 to 10. And it turns out if you've been drinking bitter things beforehand, you actually are more harsh on that story. And sort of the other... end of the disgust angle is if you get the participants in an experiment like that to wash their hands and clean themselves up beforehand, they are actually less harsh. So if they feel very clean and germ-free and so on, they become less morally harsh. So morality and disgust are linked, and that might be a reason why some people are opposed morally to pornography. Not all of them, of course. But anyway, we're not talking about moral arguments tonight. We're just focusing on the evidence. So, what do people say about pornography? What are the arguments that people make that are against the use or the making of pornography? This is one of the books I read recently. This is by Professor Gail Dines. It's called Pornland, and it's I think it's fair to say fairly biased look at the pornography industry. She says at one point that porn is a process of dehumanizing a group as a way to justify cruelty, and that's not something that porn producers invented. In fact, the Nazi propaganda machine have used that tactic before. So there were quite extreme claims here. We're getting sort of a link to Nazi Germany. That was quite an eyebrow raiser for me. Another argument that's made quite often is that porn encourages rape. So Robin Morgan, the famous feminist writer in the 80s, wrote that pornography is the theory and rape is the practice. And Professor Dines, in her book, actually says, well, we wouldn't want to argue something as sort of as harsh as that. We wouldn't want to quite go that far. But she does say in a lecture that porn gives men a sense of entitlement to women's bodies, and what is rape if not a sense of entitlement to women's bodies? So I think there's a heavy suggestion here that pornography could be encouraging things like rape. Later on in her book, Professor Dines says that, you probably can't read this at the back, I'll just read it out. In virtually all porn today, she says, women completely shave their pubic hair. So we now have a generation of men who are sexually aroused by images of genitalia that look like children. Slightly odd way of phrasing it. I've never seen genitalia that look like children, I don't know about you. Anyway, what is going to be the result of this in a few years, she says, when these men start to have daughters? We don't know. We don't have any studies. But we're absolutely playing with fire here, she says. And you can see her make those comments on a video on YouTube if you look up Gail Dines on YouTube. So this is quite an extreme claim. Clearly this is saying that men are more likely to become pedophiles if they watch pornography, or at least certain types of pornography, or at least some men are. And indeed, Professor Robert Jensen, who's a journalism professor, has said that porn is what the end of the world looks like. Quite an extreme claim, you might think, but to be fair, I think what he's saying is porn is where men and women stop sort of caring for each other. They start using each other for their own sort of sexual gratification, and so that's the end of the sort of society that we want to live in. So pretty extreme claims, pretty powerful claims, and these are by sort of mainstream anti-pornography activists. These aren't from sort of the lunatic fringe or anything. Some other things that pornography... some other things that pornography is apparently is claimed to do. So one of the major arguments, of course, is that it ruins the lives of the performers. So the people in pornography are abused. There's STDs going around. They don't necessarily consent to the things that are done with them and to them in pornography films. All these ones, there's less research on it. It's hard to really get solid evidence on these things. Professor Dines claims that pornography encourages racism. So, for instance, propagating the stereotype that Asian women are submissive, or black men are sort of very sexually violent, and so on. She's the whole chapter in her book about that. It socializes men and women to be unsatisfied with their bodies and unsatisfied with each other's bodies, and ruins their sex life. That's another one that you hear quite commonly. That it takes over the entire internet. That there's the children on the internet. They can't go 5 minutes without coming across some porn, if you pardon the phrase. And porn is taking over our culture entirely. So no matter where you look, pornography has sort of seeped in. So Professor Dines talks about leaky images. Easy. Talks about leaky images which leak into all parts of our life. So these are the things that are said about it. Let's quickly get a definition of pornography. The Greek root of the word pornography, and I didn't know this, is quite interesting. Maybe one of the only interesting things in the talk. The Greek root of the word pornography, it means writing about prostitutes, which is quite interesting, I thought. There's a very sort of long and boring debate about what constitutes erotica and what constitutes pornography. So what I'll say as my definition of pornography for this talk is... sexually explicit materials designed to arouse people who consume them. That I think that's a fair definition, and that consumption could be watching it on a video, or reading it, or listening to it, or whatever it happens to be, right? And so the other argument is that what we might have thought was porn in, decades ago wouldn't be thought of as porn now. So the Playboy centerfold is not what comes to your mind now when you think about what porn is, and porn may be becoming more sort of violent or more sexually explicit, more sexually violent as time goes on. And of course then you have to get into loads of debates about what counts as violence and aggression, and how do you tell if you know, the performers are consenting or not. It's a very difficult one to do. So we're going to sort of just try and get out of those sort of arguments. There's a content analysis done of pornography by Harder and Harder. Oh, no, sorry, that's what it's called. that's what it's called. It's by Sun et al. And they looked at loads and loads of pornography and wrote down every time a certain act was performed. So every time there was a slap, they wrote it down. Every time there was a gagging or something like that, they put it down. Sorry to say words like that in front of you all. Actually, if you compare this meta-analysis to one that was done 10 years earlier, the acts of extreme violence in porn haven't actually increased very much at all. In fact, I don't think they have increased. So extreme violence such as, you know, punching, kicking, biting, all these sort of unpleasant things that are clearly done in some pornography, they haven't really increased massively in the sort of mainstream pornography that's available. And there's a critical review of that content analysis by Weitzer. I should say all these references, you can email me or tweet me, I'll send you any of these references that you want. Another argument that we don't want to have is one over the economics of porn, because it's very, very, very difficult to get figures on how much porn is worth. So in one review I saw, they said the whole porn industry is worth $4 to $10 billion worldwide. Now that's quite a big margin. It's really very hard to get a concrete figure on that. Internet porn versus DVD porn versus, so a lot of money from the porn industry comes from hotels that buy it so people can watch it in there. And so it's very difficult to get into that argument. Trust me, it's you won't find solid figures on that. People have been panicked about media and various other things which other people do for since time immemorial, essentially, from the witch hunts to the crusades to video nasties. Anyone seen Cannibal Holocaust? Yeah. Tell who the psychos in the room are. You've only seen bits of it, right? Okay, fair enough. It's pretty nasty. It's pretty nasty. Anyway, violent video games. This one is Postal 2, where I believe you can urinate on the corpses of people that you've shot, which is a great way to spend your time. Dungeons and Dragons. There was a very big moral panic about Dungeons and Dragons. I saw a study which was put on Twitter by Professor Richard Wiseman recently, which conclusively showed that Dungeons and Dragons users are not Satanists. So that's good to know. And even jazz, even things like jazz, the zip fly. I'm not wearing a zip fly, thank God. but there was a terrible panic about the zip fly when it first appeared. And so clearly, some of these moral panics are more justified than others. Maybe porn is a moral panic that's justified. We'll see. It turns out that some are not at all justified. So, for instance, let's look at video games. Here's video games. Don't know if everyone can see. This is a graph of over time the video game units sold, and that's in the red bars, and the youth violence. This is in the United States. And the youth violence is this line which is decreasing here. And this is from a review by Christopher Ferguson. So as you can see, as video games have gone up, youth violence has gone down a lot, which is not what you would expect if video games were causing violence. So here's a moral panic that's not justified. So the question is porn one of those or justified one? A lot of the literature and a lot of the media reports and things in the area of sort of media violence or sort of porn violence and so on implicitly take on the stance that people can learn to be violent. So there are ways in which we can teach others to be violent in our society, and we should stop doing that if it's all possible. So this harks back to these experiments by Albert Bandura in the 19... in psychology. And so the idea here is kids get taken into the lab and they watch a video of an adult essentially beating the shit out of a Weeble, you know, one of those things that you knock it and it comes back up. You know what I'm talking about, yeah. So they watch the videos and then they are let into a room with a Weeble there, and they found in the experiment was the kid went straight over and knocked 7 bells out of the Weeble. As you can see, the kid picking it up, throwing it and hitting it with hammers and all sorts of terrible things. Look at this sweet little child kicking the shit out of a defenseless clown. And so this is an experiment that was done, and it's been critiqued quite a lot because you know, these aren't real people that they're attacking. There's no consequences. They saw adults that were related to them do it, and so on. And there's various criticisms that are made of it. One of the other criticisms that's made is that it doesn't take into account any sort of individual differences in the kids involved. So the sort of conclusion that has been drawn, unfortunately, from this research is that you show people something and they will do it. This is the evidence. Look at these kids. But what if some people are more susceptible to this sort of influence than others? And that sort of stuff has been kind of neglected. One of the reasons people might be more susceptible is that they have some sort of genetic predisposition to be more violent, say. And so, yeah, this is another, just to highlight the fact we've had this debate in another sector quite recently with the riots that we had in some cities in down in England. This whole situations versus dispositions argument came out into the media massively. Some people say, well, it's just the way you bring these kids up, and you know, they just see people being violent to each other, so that's what they do. And then you've got other people saying, well, no, these people are just violent, that's the way they are, and so this argument comes out. So we're going to apply this to pornography. One book you might read on this whole situations versus dispositions, nature nurture thing, is Steven Pinker's The Blank Slate, which is, I think, a masterpiece. To the pornography. I know you've been waiting for that. There are four kinds of studies that have been done into pornography, broadly. Four kinds of studies. So we've got experimental studies, which is where you take people into the lab, you show them some pornography, and then you measure their aggression or any sort of views or beliefs that they have. Survey studies, which is you just give people a survey. How often do you use porn? What sorts of porn do you watch? And also, what are your attitudes towards, say, your attitudes towards women? Criminal studies are the third kind, and that's they look at sex offenders in prison and say see if they are using more pornography than other people in prison who are not sex offenders, say. And the aggregate studies, and I think these are the most interesting, I don't know if you'll agree, aggregate studies are where you look at long-term trends in societies and say, okay, here's the pornography availability in this society, what is happening to the crime rate or the rape rate or the sexual assault rate or the indecent exposure rate, say, whatever it happens to be. So these are the sort of big scale, I think, really interesting studies. We'll get to them at the end. So first of all, experimental studies. I get people into the lab, make them watch porn, possibly like this, I don't know. One of the first ones that was done in the 1980s was by Neil Malamuth, who's at University of California, can't remember which one, but one of the University of California universities. And he got students to listen to stories, so it's sort of audible pornography, auditory pornography. They listened to rape stories. And the ones that had those rape stories, they were asked to write down their fantasies. And compared to a control group who didn't listen to rape stories, they had more violence in their sexual fantasies that they wrote down. So that's a sort of one of the first studies which found this sort of connection. Again, you might wonder how much this actually applies to the pornography as we see it today. Same guy again with a colleague in 1986 wrote an article where they claimed they made people watch either violent porn, non-violent porn, or just a video of, I don't know, fluffy bunnies or something like that, something that isn't pornography. They watched these videos 10 times over a four-week period. And they claim in the abstract of their study, that is the summary of the study at the top of the article, that they found effects, that they found that violence, that watching violent porn had large effects on aggression, sexual aggression. But actually, they didn't find any effects at all. If you look at the paper, there's no effects in there. So there's this strange disconnect between what they wrote in the summary and what is in the paper. So bear that one in mind. These guys in 1994, they show people positive or negative violent porn. Now, you might be thinking that positive violent porn is an oxymoron, but it's pornography where, violent pornography where either the woman, I think it was a man being violent towards a woman, the woman was resisting in some way, or in the positive stuff, she was actively enjoying it, as it were. And so they were then asked about their acceptance of rape myths, so, you know, things like, sometimes women deserve to be raped if they're drunk, or all these terrible things that a ridiculous number of people in our society believe. They were asked what their acceptance of those were. And no effects were found at all of any kind of pornography on acceptance of those sort of rape myths. So that's quite interesting. But of course, you might be thinking, well, when was the last time you went into a psychology lab? You know, when was the last time when you were watching pornography, you were in a psychology lab, the porn was given to you by a psychologist. Often, I don't know about you, but when you're watching pornography, you tend to also be doing something else, which is probably inappropriate to do in the psychology lab, right? So these might have an issue with ecological validity. That is, they're not really that true to life. But not only that, there are contradictory studies. You know, some find some kind of effect and some don't. What Chris Ferguson in the review says that the effects, they seem to be fairly small, they seem to be negligible, temporary, and difficult to generalize to the real world. And I think it's hard to disagree with his conclusion when you look at the experimental studies. Other problems are things like, you know, if you've got a measure of aggression, does that really measure how aggressive people are in the real world, or just how they happen to feel at that moment? You know, you can feel aggressive at that moment and maybe write something down that you might be aggressive in the future, but you're not the sort of person to ever actually, you know, do anything aggressive towards another person. So you know, there's a problem with these aggression measures, and yeah, so none of these show real aggression effects. But you know, what the comment that Professor Dines makes on these sorts of studies is, well, these provide some sort of indication of effects, but what I find most compelling are the stories I hear from women who've been raped by men who use porn. Well, you know, anecdotes are fair enough, but they, as we know at the Skeptic Society, the plural of anecdote is not data, and that's not really a critique of the studies. It's a sort of, I've already made my mind up and I'm only going to listen to stories, anecdotes, which prove my point of view. So that's an unimpressive statement. Survey studies. So what sort of porn do you watch? How aggressive are you? What do you think about women? So on. When I first started researching these sort of studies, I found a meta-analysis, which has been done in 2010. That's when you take all the studies from an area and synthesize them and try and see what way the general sort of effect goes in all these studies. And Neil Malamuth and some colleagues in 2010 provided a meta-analysis, and they found that the correlation, the statistical correlation between pornography use and negative attitudes towards women was, for non-violent pornography, was about 0.13, which is pretty small, but it's statistically significant, and for violent pornography, it was 0.24, which is larger, but still fairly small. So these are you know, interesting effects. I thought, wow, okay, that's good. That's good evidence that porn has negative effects. And then I found studies which they've missed. Now, of course, when you're doing a meta-analysis, what you want to do is add in as many studies as you possibly can. But they failed to include a couple of studies, such as this one by Garris et al. In 2004. They asked people how much they watched porn and what sorts of porn it was, and gave them sexism scales. And these were different sexism scales, so they gave them a sort of negative sexism scale. That is, you know, negative sexism is defined as, you know, how much people dislike women. You know, women are stupid, women are inferior, and so on. And they also gave them positive sexism scales. We'll come to that in just a moment. For the negative sexism scales, they correlate negatively with pornography use. That is, in this study, the more porn you watch, the less sexist you were towards women, or less sexist attitudes you had. Which seems counterintuitive, especially when you see the claims that people make about porn and have made about porn in the past. And so you think, well, why might this be? My guess is that people who are sort of open and liberal towards women's rights and things like that also tend to be open and liberal towards watching people having sex and things like that. And that could be an explanation, certainly. One study in the 80s found that porn users were less authoritarian than non-porn users. And that's kind of what you'd expect. You know, people from a sort of conservative religious background would tend to watch less porn, or at least admit to watching less porn than non-religious people or non-conservative people. So then we get to this positive sexism thing. So this is often also called benevolent sexism, and it's sort of an attitude that, oh, you know, women are a bit weaker and they need to be protected and, you know, all this sort of thing. And here's a gentleman here. Oh, that picture's... No, there it is. Gentleman here engaging in positive sexism. Possibly he's just opening the door, but it's the only picture I could find that illustrated anything to do with sort of positive sexism. But you get what I mean. Anyway, there was a small... positive effect of pornography on this benevolent sexism. That is, the more porn you watch, the more you tend to think women need to be protected and shielded from the big bad world out there and so on. So that is a negative effect. Benevolent sexism does sound fairly, well, benevolent, but it's not really. It's imagine, you know, going for a job interview and not getting the job because, oh, she's a woman, maybe she's a bit weak and so on. So, you know, this sexism does have seriously bad effects on society. It's a very small relationship to pornography. And again, it's just one study. This is the only study that's ever looked at that before. Another study, which was missed in this meta-analysis, was one by Alan McKee in Australia in 2007. And he actually looked at, I think, 1,023 users of porn. So this is a much bigger sample size than any of the previous experiments was looked at. And he, I think what he did was he got questionnaires and he sent them out. He got in touch with a porn DVD distribution company, and he got them to send out questionnaires with their DVDs, which were then sent back to his psychology department. He also put a questionnaire up online, and over 1,000 people filled it in, which is very good. And these were not just students. So all the previous research we've seen, or pretty much all the previous research, has been done on students. This is a problem we have in psychology, which is, you know, there are all these undergraduate students running around the department. Just grab them in and make them do the experiments. Don't look any further. So we have this sort of convenience sampling problem, which can sort of distort the generalizability of the findings in a lot of this research. Anyway, McKee found that there were absolutely no relationships between any form of... So these were all porn users, right? But between the amount of porn you watched and the amount of negative attitudes towards women, there was zero relationship. So these were studies which were not included in the meta-analysis, and I thought that was very strange. I think the one reason maybe they were not was because there were a few women included in these two studies. And what Malamuth and colleagues said at the start of their meta-analysis was, we're only looking at sexism, sort of male sexism towards women. That seems a bit of a strange thing to look at, especially given these studies don't have many women in them. You know, most users of porn are male, as you might imagine. And, you know, when you're doing a meta-analysis, just email the people that did the study and ask for their male data. You know, don't keep out studies just because they don't quite fit your inclusion criteria, right? So, bit of a strange thing to do, to drop them from the meta-analysis. But I expect if you add those studies in and maybe some other ones that they missed out, that would really reduce the effect that they found, which is already quite small. So just bear that in mind when you see meta-analyses like that. Have they included everything that they could have? One more study I found just last night, just to throw in there, one by Popovich, and a very recent one, and I think it's in the current issue of the journal Archives of Sexual Behaviour, which is a fascinating journal. You should read it. It's really quite amazing. Loads of great studies in there. They found that men who watched more porn, so the more porn these people watched, the more desire for intimacy and an intimate relationship with a woman they had, which is quite interesting. It doesn't seem to fit with sort of a hatred of women, and it doesn't fit with men using pornography instead of having relationships or instead of having, you know, normal relationships with women, as a lot of the anti-porn campaigners have suggested. So those are the survey studies. Don't have a critique of those, but I guess the critique of them is they're self-report, right? So you're writing things down, you're answering questions about yourself, and, you know, honesty is difficult to 100% guarantee in these studies. Although most surveys have been tested on samples, and you could even include little joke questions in there to make sure people are paying attention and so on. So, you know, survey studies might seem not the best way to do things, but modern day psychology has quite good methods for this sort of thing. So to our third section of studies, criminal studies. Anyone recognize this gentleman? Yeah. Always good to have one of the serial killer obsessives in the audience. So he's a serial killer. Any idea how many people he killed? Lot right. When I was at Edinburgh, someone said 49, which is I think exactly right. What were their names? What were their names? I said. Anyway, he's a fascinating character, actually, Ted Bundy. If you haven't read his story, it's worth reading. He was an evil serial killer. Obviously, he killed lots of women, and he was a rapist and a necrophile as well, I think. And but the fascinating thing about him is his life was a bit like a horror film. He or some kind of Hollywood movie. He escaped from prison twice. The second time by tunneling out of his jail cell. Like, really quite an amazing story. Anyway, the second time he tunneled out from prison, he was caught and he was put on the electric chair. And just before, on death row for the electric chair, I should say. While he was on death row, he did a series of interviews with a Christian anti-pornography charity. And he said, well, the reason I did what I did was because I'm addicted to pornography. I can't stop watching pornography. My grandfather got me into pornography at a young age, and I've been, you know, perverted my whole life by pornography. And this Christian charity, you know, this was music to their ears, of course. The worst serial killer in America at that point was a porn user, a high porn user, used voluminous amounts of pornography. And you can actually go into some Christian websites now, and they say things like, if you use pornography, look how he turned out. You're going to turn out just like that if you use pornography, guys. So just bear that in mind. To make of that what you will, but the experts on Ted Bundy and his psychiatrists at the time thought that this was kind of just a ruse to try and sort of desperately get out of his death row punishment by saying, well, you know, I've had a reason for it. There's an excuse here, like the kind of the Twinkie defense, the porn defense, maybe. But what have the actual studies said? So that's one case. One example. What have the actual studies said? Well, here's one in 1970. They found that rapists in prison they visited were older than control people when they were exposed to porn. The control people were other criminals in the prison who were not rapists. So that's quite interesting. In 1973, there was a study that found that rapists were had been more likely to be punished in their life for pornography, and they actually had a more repressive religious upbringing. So the idea here is that they had sort of more guilt about pornography in their life. Here's one by a very well-named person, possibly for these kind of studies, Nutter and Kearns, in 1993. They found that child molesters in a prison were older than controls when they were exposed to porn, and there was no difference in the use of porn between child abusers and criminals in the same prison. The most recent one that I saw was Allen et al. In 1989, and they found no differences in the use of pornography, again, between sex offenders and controls. So here's this whole thing again about situations and dispositions. So is it just a situational thing that you know, the more porn you watch, the more like Ted Bundy you become? Well, that doesn't seem to be borne out by the studies. In fact, any situational explanations seem to go the other way. That is, the less porn you've watched, the more likely you are to be sort of repressed and become a rapist. Now, I think the evidence is far too flimsy to make any sort of conclusion along those lines. I think this is quite old research as well, and you should be very cautious, you know, coming to any sort of those sort of conclusions. But certainly, there doesn't seem to be any reason to think that the more porn these people watched, the more likely they were to become sex offenders. You will see a few sort of interviews done by people like Professor Gail Dines with sex offenders, and where the sex offenders say, well, Professor Dines, I'm addicted to pornography. Again, it's a similar sort of thing to Ted Bundy. You can't ever be sure whether these people are telling you the truth, or it's just kind of an excuse, or if these people are just sort of cherry-picked. Who knows? So the criminal studies are, I would say, fairly inconclusive, although they certainly don't seem to point towards the more porn, more crime sort of theory. And then we get to my favourite studies, the aggregate studies. This is where you look at countrywide data over a long period of time. One study was done in 1999 in Japan. I should say first that the originator of these types of studies was Beryl Kaczynski at, I think he was, I can't remember which university, in Denmark. And he said, his theory was that the more porn was available in society, the less sort of sexually frustrated people would be, and the fewer incidents of sex crimes there would be, because people would just stay in and use pornography instead of going out and assaulting other people. That was his theory, and he looked at the porn availability in Denmark and in various other countries, and all his data seemed to suggest that the more porn there was in society, the fewer sex crimes there were. So that research is getting quite old now, so we can look at more recent stuff. As I said, Milton Diamond He's a professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii. And he's, with various colleagues, looked at loads of countries and the porn availability. The first one was with a colleague in Japan, Uchiyama, where now Japan has seen a sort of explosion of pornography availability over the latter half of the 20th century. And as you know, the pornography in Japan is quite different from Western pornography. It's often quite fetishistic. I heard a word, bukkake. I have no idea what that means, but again, perhaps someone can enlighten me after the talk. So Diamond says, you know, this pornography is more fetishistic, possibly even more violent than Western pornography, and so there's a massive increase in this over the latter half of the 20th century. But at the same time, exactly the same time, there's a huge decrease in sex crimes. And indeed, so did child sex crimes. They decreased as well. But child pornography was available in Japan. In fact, child pornography is still legal in Japan. Japan gets a lot of hassle from sort of the other G8 countries for this because it's still legal to possess child pornography. You can't make it or distribute it or sell it, but you can possess it. It's still legal, and you know, there's a lot of people who are quite outraged about that, as you might imagine. But child sex crimes have been decreasing in Japan for a very, very long time. Diamond and colleagues, other colleagues, have found similar stories in countries like China and Hong Kong as well. Coming back sort of Western, we've got a study by Diamond and colleagues in 2010 and looking at the Czech Republic. Now, of course, as you know, the Czech Republic was run by communists until 1989. There was a communist regime, and of course, as under most communist regimes, fun things are not permitted. So if people looked like they were enjoying themselves with a bit of pornography, that was not allowed. And pornography was banned. There was no pornography available. People had to sort of smuggle it over the borders and things like that. It's really, 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 really very well controlled. However, from 1989 onwards, there was obviously the Velvet Revolution. The Czech Republic got rid of the communist regime. Or Czechoslovakia did, and then the Czech Republic was formed. And actually, there was a massive upsurge in crime at that time. So here's a graph. As you'd imagine, when the society is in upheaval like that, crime rates increase because there's less sort of law, the sort of jackboot of the law on people that you get under communism. So you had a big increase in all crimes. But what you might notice about this graph is that this solid line here is for non-sexual crimes. And this dotted line here down at the bottom, which it sort of maybe goes down a bit, but not really massively, is for sexual crimes. So you see no jump in sexual crimes at exactly the same time as there's a massive jump in pornography availability. That is around about 1989 when you see this big jump in non-sexual crimes. So a friend of mine suggested pornography causes non-sexual crimes, but I don't think that's really a conclusion that you can draw from this. But what you can draw is the availability of pornography doesn't seem to have caused a spike in sexual crimes. Quite interesting. Child sex crimes also decreased in the same time, or decreased. I think they decreased a bit more than adult sex crimes. But child pornography was legal in the Czech Republic for a very long time. Indeed, it's only now become illegal, thank heavens. So Diamond is sort of waiting now to do a study on the child sex crime in the Czech Republic now that child pornography has been banned. So that's an interesting thing, controversial. One more country that this has been done in. So here is, this is from Christopher Ferguson again, excellent researcher, you should look him up, he's very good. And here is the availability of hardcore pornography titles in America. From 1988 to 2005, and there's a huge increase, as you might expect. There's been a big increase in pornography as society has become more sort of liberalized. And this red line here is the rape rate, and this might remind you of the video game one that we saw earlier on. So as pornography has increased, the rape rate in America, or at least the reported rape rate, obviously there's big questions over that sort of stuff, has decreased hugely. Now, obviously, what you can't say is, the availability of pornography is decreasing sex crimes from this data, because correlation, as we know, the Skeptic Society, does not imply causation. Well, it does imply causation, but it doesn't equal causation, right? So it's not the same thing as causation. So what you might say is, well, the rape rate might have decreased even faster if pornography hadn't been available, right? But what you certainly can't say from looking at data like this is that pornography has caused a spike in the rape rate, or the availability of harder and harder pornography has really knocked up this red line. Of course, there's lots of issues with these aggregate studies. It's unclear that they really answer the question. You can't know from looking at countrywide trends if the people who are doing who are perpetrating the sex crimes are those who are watching the pornography, for instance, because you've not done these sort of survey crimes. Although, you know, it is a prediction of the porn causes rape hypothesis that there would be an increase, there would be some sort of relation, and not a negative relationship. But the real killer thing with these studies is the rape report and conviction rates. So, as we know, one of the real scandals of modern societies is that rape is one of the lowest conviction rates and a very low reporting rate. But the question is, what would the availability of porn do to the reporting rate of rape? So some people have suggested that more porn suggests to people in society that there's more acceptance of rape, so there's more sort of sex, violent sex going on with women, and so they see this more often and they think, well, people are okay with this. And so that would cause fewer people to report rape. On the other hand, other theorists have suggested that more porn means that the countries have become more liberalized, and that means people are more likely to report rape. So more porn is generally available in more liberalized countries. Diamond points out that it does seem to be this way for Japan and the Czech Republic, because after the communist regime and in the second half of the 20th century for the Czech Republic, for Japan, far more rape crisis centres, rape counselling centres sprung up, and you'd think people would be more likely to report rape than before, when it was a sort of a secret or sort of tragic crime. It's hard to say. Although what really impresses me is the cross-national, cross-cultural consistency of this data. So as far as I'm aware, in every single study, in every single country this has been studied in, the availability of porn has been negatively associated with the incidence of sex crimes. And that's quite striking to me. I don't know what you think. You can we can talk about this in the Q&A if you like. So we get to the conclusion now. So what we've seen is there's a lot of sort of bias and value judgments about pornography, and a lot of sort of moral arguments made about it. Lots of sort of personal opinions. But there's also an enormous amount of research and lots of different kinds of research as well. So it's quite hard to get your head around all this stuff. Certainly it was for me. But I think what we can generally conclude is any negative effects of pornography on things like crime and negative attitudes towards women are very weak. They don't seem to last very long, and often they're not found at all. Sometimes it's even in the opposite direction. So what you've got is a very a conflicting data set, but one which sort of moves around zero. You've got a cluster of sort of points around zero, as far as I can see. The biggest effects on pornography seem to be in sort of at-risk groups, so people who are more likely to perpetrate sort of sex crimes, as you would expect. And it's a bit like the media violence, the computer game, movie violence, literature, in that nobody really considers dispositional variables, and there's this assumption that sort of monkey see, monkey do. If you watch people having emotionless sex in pornography, then you will also have emotionless sex yourself, and that may eventually turn you into some sort of sex offender. But that's probably not necessarily the case. Probably not necessarily the case. Terrible sentence. My apologies for that one. What you might say, though, is that all these studies have been done before pornography has become more violent, as it has in recent years. But the question is, well, has it? It's not clear. There's not really solid data on whether porn has become more violent or not. Certainly mainstream pornography. I mean, obviously, there's terrible pornography out there, but it's whether this has become the mainstream or not. And the, you know, more research is needed before we know how the level of violence in pornography has increased over time and if this has had any effect on anything. And one other thing, sort of right at the start, I mentioned the actresses and actors in pornography and how they're abused and all that. We haven't really come into that in the talk because the data doesn't exist on this stuff. So how many people are abused in pornography? How many people are forced to do non-consensual things in pornography? Well, who knows? It's just not, the data is not out there. But an analogy could be drawn with the prostitution debate, where people say, well, you know, if it's underground and illegal, then that creates more opportunities for abuse, for the prostitutes to be exploited, sexually transmitted diseases to be spread and all that sort of stuff. And so maybe more regulation of the pornography industry will stop any abuses that happen in it. And so that's something which I think we could maybe talk about in the Q&A as well. And I think, as far as I'm aware, up till now, that is the science of porn. And you can email me and get any of those studies or tweet me if you like. And all that remains to say is thanks very much for listening. Cheers.